we said on every call, we hope we don't do too many more of these, but appreciate everybody taking time out of your busy schedules to talk about all the really important issues that are keeping us all up at night these days, but also giving us some sense of hope and optimism as we move towards the revival mode of this interesting experience that we're all living through. So the past couple of weeks, we've talked about survival. We've touched upon all the things dealing with difficult decisions to transition employees, to layoffs and furloughs, also the CARES Act and real estate strategies and a whole bunch of other things. Oh, by the way, this is Riley Loggison, chair of the National Restaurant Industry Practice, for those that don't know me. And our group here at DWT is dedicated to helping restaurant groups navigate these issues, as you know. And, well, we've never seen anything like this, but I think the good news is with everybody working together in the collective efforts of a lot of great people, we're going to get through this. And there's also some hope that we'll even get in position to come back stronger. So for all those listening in today, really appreciate all the efforts that you're making. We understand, you know, you've had to make a lot of difficult decisions, and things have been very tough, but they will get better. And so today we've got a really dynamic agenda, and we wanted to focus on things that we've been hearing from you, you know, to learn more about as things progress. And we'd heard that a lot of you are really interested in the landscape ahead. Now that we've spent a few weeks getting a handle on the current state of affairs and watching some of the things evolve legislatively and otherwise, really how we are going to get back to business and when we're going to get back to business and what it's going to look like. And what steps are groups taking, you know, in other parts of the country and in different places to get everyone positioned for a return? And also, what can we do as a group and how we can be proactive to influence the policies that are going to impact the industry on a go-forward basis? So with that, I would like to start off the program by introducing you to a great friend and a client of ours, Kurt Huffman, CEO of Chef's Table Group. Kurt and team are based out here in Portland, Oregon. And interesting fact, Kurt and I go way back to our high school days when we were in Latin class, among other things, together. I think if I recall, Kurt got a better grade in Latin than I did. He really seemed to, you know, have an aptitude for it. And but he's one of the most talented, dynamic restaurateurs that you will meet. He has, you know, his company is, you know, really interesting, really dynamic. He is ahead of the curve on really everything, especially on chef-driven and on the culinary side. And when talking to him over the last couple of weeks, it came obvious that he had jumped on things before lots of others, seeing this, you know, on the horizon, and has done a bunch of very, I think, smart and proactive things to get his company his best position to come out of this. So, Kurt, really appreciate you taking the time to join us today. So why don't you tell us a little bit about you know, what you and Chef's Table do.
So I apologize. I just got a brand new computer, and I hope you're hearing me.
We are. Yes, thank
Great.
You.
So I started Chef's Table 11 years ago. We partner with chefs, and we open more or less whatever restaurant they're interested in trying to open. And as anybody in the restaurant industry knows, every chef has an idea of a restaurant in their back pocket that they've always dreamt of opening and feel like will do really well. They probably have the menu hidden away somewhere on their laptop. So for 11 years, we've been partnering with different chefs here in Portland. The first was Andy Ricker from Pock Pock. And then we went on to do about 30 restaurants in the last 11 years. And we've exited some, and some have not worked out. But currently we have 24 leases and I believe 16 different concepts. And with some of our partners, we've gone on to scale. So with Rick Gencarelli, who I met when he was in a food cart, he had a little sandwich cart called Lardo. And we went on to open up a brick and mortar for him. And then subsequently, we've opened up six other places, two Lardos and two of his fast casual pasta concepts called Grassa. And then we have other concepts that we, with Greg and Gabby Denton from Ox, which is an Argentine steakhouse, we opened a French restaurant called Bistro Agnes. So we have a total of 16 concepts, I guess you could say, under management. And after we help people open their restaurants and fund it and everything, then we provide all the back-end management services. So we help with everything, bill pay, accounting, performance analytics, HR advice. So essentially, we take care of everything that we can take care of not at the restaurant, and they take care of everything at the restaurant. So that's Chef's Table.
Well, thanks, Kurt. I know you also have a licensed location of Lardo at the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas. I know that's Vegas has been closed down for quite some time too, and that it's been a real mix of what you're able to do under the restrictions that working under. You're doing some delivery and takeout. Some of your places and some are closed down entirely. Correct.
Yeah. So I'm looking here at our list of the 23 leases we have. We're doing takeout of some sort at 12 of them. And then the balance are closed. The delivery has been a struggle for us at our traditional sit-down restaurants. And then some restaurants are just better built for it, like our fast casual restaurants. So at our fast casual, which is Grasso, Lardo, XLB, which is a Xiaoling Bao, it's a steam bun, soup dumpling concept. Those places have done well, relatively well. We're at about 35% of our normal income. And then the other places, especially sit-down places, just aren't, it doesn't make any sense, or it's just very, very hard to manage. And of the places that we're doing it, we've had to close down one because one of the people that worked there, her roommate, who worked as a nurse, ended up testing positive. And in the absence of testing to see if she had any issues, we just had to close down the entire restaurant for 2 weeks, have everybody self-quarantine, and then we'll, if everybody's fine 2 weeks later, we'll reopen it. But that's just to illustrate the volatility of the moment, of even trying to manage some sort of takeout.
Well, Kurt, what I found really, I think helpful about your experience is that, one, you became aware that there was going to be an issue early on. I mean, being out here in the Pacific Northwest and seeing what was happening in Seattle, you decided to get proactive very early on. And from that point, you've continued a dialogue with your landlords, and you've been able to successfully negotiate. And you're one, I think it's important, you're also a landlord, so you have the experience of being in that position too, which I think we're seeing become very helpful in understanding their needs, in connection with the needs of the restaurateur. But maybe talk about when you identify the problem, the steps that you've taken with the landlords, how it's kind of progressed, and where you're ending up with some.
So sometime around March 1st, as my memory is, around the time that Tom Douglas closed down all of his restaurants in Seattle, or maybe it's a few days before that. In any case, somewhere around March 1st, I had heard the stories about just the total collapse of the Seattle restaurant market. And I reached out to all my landlords at that point saying, I think something terrible is coming down I-5. And I think that we're going to be in a position here where we're going to be closed soon. And we need to start talking about rent relief, because if that happens, this is the worst possible time of the year for that to happen in terms of our cash position. And we're going to be hurting. And so of the 22 landlords I have, I heard back from two saying that they'd want to talk about it, but I was no response at all from the rest of them. And then I closed down our restaurants, or I advised to my partners that we closed down our restaurants on, let me think, it feels like a lifetime ago, but it was on Sunday the 15th of March. I suggest we close down. So on Thursday the 12th, I wrote again to all the landlords saying, I believe we're going to be closed soon, and I'm going to be advising all my partners to not pay any rent while we're closed. And I just want to let you know that. And then once, and again, I heard back at that point from two landlords, both of who reached out, said, hey, we want to work with you. We value you as a tenant, and we also see this as being a very big issue that's looming. The governor shut us down on March 17th, and I started reaching out again to landlords, just confirming the fact that due to the crisis, we weren't paying rent. And then I started hearing from landlords slowly. And I think that it took time for them to digest the situation, to probably get counsel from their lawyers about what to do. And I think the gravity of the moment didn't really sink in until the end of March or early April. And at that point, they started giving me offers, which were something along the lines of, hey, we'll give you you don't need to pay rent in April, and we'll figure out how you pay it back over the next year. And I, by that point, had already proceeded to get an extension on I have two commercial properties. I have a triplex, which used to be the Chef's Table office in my house. And then we moved into a warehouse, which I was able to buy last October. And in both of those, you know, I reached out right when we closed, found out that the two mortgage lenders I have both had COVID-19 programs in place. And on my warehouse, I got a 3-month extension. So essentially they extended the term of my mortgage by 3 months, and I'm going to pay nothing for 3 months. And on my triplex, it was a similar program. So when I reached out to my landlords after getting those kinds of offers, I said, no, I'm not going to pay you back. You're going to have to figure out either a way like I did to extend my lease by 3 months and I pay nothing during that extension period when you're not having to pay, except I would consider paying triple nets and interest. I didn't tell them that, but that was kind of my position, is that these programs are out there. They need to take advantage of it. And then they need to pass those savings along to me. And I thought that was the best case scenario, is that I'm not in an adversarial relationship with them. And to date, the sum we have been able to extend our lease by 3 months with no rent at 15 of the 23 leases we have. So they've, on all of those, we've effectively were not paying anything for 3 months, except for triple nets. We are agreeing to a 3-month extension in the term of our lease. The balance of them have essentially granted us no rent in April, and they want to deal with this month to month. I have one lease, which is for our first Lardo, and the total lease payment is $4,200 a month. It's a former Winchell's Donuts that is 1,200 square feet. So he's a retiree that lives in Palm Springs, and he's giving us $1,000 off a month. And that's just too valuable of a location for us to push him too hard on. So, but everywhere else, we're either paying nothing or triple nets.
So, Kurt, it sounds like the proposition that's been very successful is essentially tacking on 3 additional months at the end of the lease in exchange for no rent for April, May, and June. Is that
Yes. And the only reason I can think that that's working is because that's a common program that's being offered in the commercial mortgage sector. I know that's what I got on my warehouse. And I know that my partner, who's a client of yours, Riley, Chris Briggs, he owns a building where I have two concepts. And that was the deal that he got. He got a full 3-month extension. So we're basically just paying triple nets during the closure. So it seems to be a common offer. And it's always these touchy moments, right, when you're trying to refer to your lawyers and making sure you're not saying the wrong things and exposing yourself somehow to liability with your landlords. But you're also wanting to be transparent given the gravity of the moment. And just try to cut through all the bullshit with these people and say, look, I'm going to close if you fight me. If we get in a fight, neither of us win. So we have to get through all of the mumbo jumbo and the lawyers speak. And we have to just talk, get real talk about programs that are out there, how you don't go bankrupt, how I don't go bankrupt, and how we find a situation that's okay. And by the way, 3 months, 3 months of free rent puts me April, May, June. I'm July 1st, and I may not even be able to open by July 1st. So this is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the volatility that we have to deal with. And then I have to deal with 6-foot spacing between all my guests. My 75-seat restaurants turn into 33-seat restaurants. We're going to be dealing with me then needing to go back and say, honestly, guys, the best I can do here is pay percentage rent. And we need to do a 12-month period of percentage rent only. And I realize that's terrible for you, but we've got to figure out a way to get through this.
Yeah, and I think, Kurt, that is the approach. I think your approach is, and others on the phone, I imagine, are taking a very similar approach in being proactive and trying to get a place to at least where right now where it makes sense. And I think you put on the caveats that still don't know how everything is going to play out over the next few months, when it will be prudent to return to business and what restrictions or conditions will be on social distancing or anything else. Reaching a firm agreement with a landlord on all terms, might not be prudent or possible at this time. But to get an understanding on the basic economics in the interim, provide some level of comfort and certainty, at least for the next couple of months.
And I've been, Riley, what was interesting to me that I didn't expect is that the larger companies, like the companies that are massive property management groups all over that have locations all over the country, they have been the ones that have been the easiest to deal with. And the building owned by a guy that has two buildings has been by far the hardest. So the corporate ownership seems to have grasped the situation much better, and also perhaps has more leverage with their lenders to force kinds of solutions that I'm proposing. So our high-rise buildings have been really wonderful with us. And it took a while to get them there, but I think once they, because they're in, their responsibility to their shareholders is collect rent. But I think once I punched back hard saying, I'm not repaying you and I'm not paying rent, and if you expect somebody else to come in the next 18 months and take over this space because you kicked me out, you're dreaming. So let's find a solution. Once they took it up a level, the big people that I worked with both came back and completely changed their tune and said, we're going to do that. 3 months extension of your lease, no rent for 3 months.
And to those on the phone, if you have questions, use the Q&A button. We'll try to get to as many as possible on the call or after. But I think, Kurt, to your point, what we're seeing too from some of the larger developers and landlords out there, I think for the first time, at least that I've seen it, they're reaching out and trying to engage in this conversation with tenants. We have a call today. I have one with a fairly significant landlord that wants to establish a landlord-tenant forum type of restaurant group, to figure out the ways to work through this. Perhaps that's, an idea for another call that we could do with this group specifically, to focus on, some maybe standard approaches to leases on a go-forward basis to get some uniformity. Because that's what I think, one, it will cut through, the lawyer mumbo-jumbo, which, no offense taken. This is really not the time to be, pouring through every single word in a lease and looking at, all these creative defenses and, frustration of purpose and impossibility, all this stuff. At least the first couple of weeks, everybody's looking at. Not saying it's not important to look at your leases, but because it certainly is for ascertaining lots of things, personal guarantees and responsibilities. But if there's going to be a solution to move things forward, it's really going to come from the business terms. And those are terms that we cannot yet determine at this point, what's going to be right or reasonable. We've talked to general counsels at some of the largest restaurant groups in the country and how they're looking at it. Others, is it going to be a staged percentage rent basis that they try to go towards, to kind of get back to the right level of occupancy cost, these properties? And so, I think to your point, to get to the right place, it's going to require transparency and dialogue and working together to get everybody back and to comfortable getting back. Because as you said, if you can't get terms that make sense for you, it's no point in reopening.
That's exactly right.
Well, Kurt, if you could hang on the call here as long as possible, that would be great. There will be questions coming up and really appreciate you take the time to talk about what you and Chef Stable are doing and all the great work that your team is doing during this difficult time. And for those on the phone, and Kurt, I don't know if you'd be willing to share your information, if people have questions that they want to ask you, but it would give you the opportunity to do that. Don't want to get your inbox bombarded, but you've got great info and if you're willing to share, happy to get it out there.
Yeah, and I'm happy to talk about other things too. I mean, currently we're the places that are working. The number one problem I'm facing right now with the places that are doing to-go food is staffing them, because I can't get people off of unemployment. Here in Oregon, you get $600 a week or up to $600 a week. So our average line cook's probably getting about $250 a week. And now that the federal money's kicked in, they're making $850 a week, $800 a week. That's like getting paid $17, $18 an hour. So for me to offer them $15 an hour, which is what we start our cooks at here in Portland, I can't even get them to agree to come back in unless I'm offering them, a well-paid full-time job. So, I'm just in this new pickle, which is the labor markets are completely different than you'd ever think they would be in the middle of an administrative closure.
Yeah, and here's the perverse irony of it. So we're living in like one giant Aflac commercial for the next couple of months, and you have your employees that are not wanting to come back to work that are ordering lardo on Grubhub. They're not there to make it. So
that's exactly right. Yeah. And what's crazy is that we raised like $20,000 to help feed our employees through our takeout programs, so they get free meals. So you're exactly right. I'm asking them to come back to work. They don't want to. And they're making at a minimum $2,400 a month in unemployment benefits. And $2,400, what am I saying? $3,200, right? They're getting $600 in federal and at least $200 in state. So it's like, at this point, I don't see how I'm going to be able to open until the end of the federal benefits in July 31st. I don't know how I'm going to staff a restaurant. So it's crazy times.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Kurt, for sharing. And if anybody has questions to send along, we'll get them to Kurt. And Kurt, is it okay for me to share your email address for those? There's all fellow restaurateurs, so.
Yeah, of course.
I'm not going to get, I think, any weird inquiries, but it's, unless you want, but you know, it's Kurt, K-U-R-T, at chefstablegroup.com. So just as it sounds, Kurt at chefstablegroup.com. And Kurt, thank you so much. Wishing you and the team all the best as we work through this, and look forward to having you back on future episodes of our workshop, hopefully not too many more of them. All right, well, in this time that is, I think, novel, it lends itself to opportunities for restaurateurs, in ways that we haven't had a chance to do things for a long time, if ever, with respect to policies and legislation and other things that may be restaurant friendly. I live here on the West Coast, and I know a lot of folks on the East Coast and other markets over the last few years that have seen a number of policies come into play that have increased the pressures of operating, increased the cost of operating, made it more difficult to do pretty much everything that is really important to do in the restaurant space to justify being in it and being profitable. What we're seeing right now is an unprecedented window of opportunity to make things change for the positive. And it's going to be by virtue of necessity for a lot of our cities and other areas that are impacted by the loss of jobs in particular. We are involved behind the scenes in a major market in the U.S. where there is the expressed willingness to think outside of the box and to do things that would not otherwise be done to accelerate the return of jobs, the workforce, with the restaurant industry a very high priority, if not the highest priority. And so this lends a unique opportunity to hopefully advance some of the policies that a lot of folks have been working on some time, because we know the restaurant industry is the best path to opportunity for people from all walks of life in different backgrounds to the skills and opportunities necessary develop skills of teamwork and collaboration and reliability and other things that can benefit those, no matter what they're doing. And we're finally seeing a receptiveness to this all over the country. And very happy today to have a very special guest, Camilla Marcus, who's founder of Westbourne in New York. Camilla has a really dynamic and impressive background. Not only is she a restaurateur, but she is also a law school graduate and an attorney. She was director of business development for Union Square Hospitality Group after that, and she's also the founder of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, and working with Roar in New York. And as a side note, also had the opportunity to work with her husband, Josh Siegel, who's a fantastic attorney and business development person in his capacity as the lead counsel at Momofuku for a number of years. So Camilla has tremendous background, and she's extremely active in helping to make sure that the road to return is as smooth as possible for restaurateurs. So Camilla, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Can you guys hear me okay?
We can, yeah. Well, thanks, Camilla. Maybe if you could kind of, give us, kind of a little bit of your background and kind of what you're doing in the restaurant space and how you have jumped into action over the last several weeks to do all the great things that you're doing.
Sure. Well, you covered most of the bases. I have a pretty cross-disciplinary background. Went to undergraduate business school at Penn, went to culinary school at the French Culinary Institute here in New York, followed up with a JD MBA at NYU. And then, as you said, actually before I worked for Danny Meyer, worked for CIM Group doing hospitality and retail acquisitions and investments. And then head of business development for Danny Meyer during a pretty pivotal time when Shake Shack was going public. We had an entirely new C-suite, 5 chef transitions and 5 openings in the manner of, I don't know, 9 to 12 months. Certainly a crash course in change management, and then left to start Westbourne, which is a mission-driven for-profit restaurant. I'm from Los Angeles originally, so in the heart of Soho, but very much speaks to my roots coming from California. And 1% of every purchase goes back to the Robin Hood Foundation for hospitality training for youth in the neighborhood, and then we hire from that program. So the economic mobility of restaurants and their position, sort of the largest contributor, I would say, to a middle class, a thriving middle class, and the importance of restaurants collectively as the single largest private employer in the country, has been something that I have been beating that drum for years now. And one of the reasons that I did create sort of a unique business model with Westbourne. March 15th, I closed the restaurant, and the very next day started calling around to a bunch of friends. I've been in and around the business for over a decade and have also worked with Tom Colicchio before Danny while I was at NYU. So really jumped into action pretty quickly, started calling a bunch of friends and realizing, you know, not only was everyone closed, but everyone had fired everyone pretty much overnight. And in talking with, you know, certain policy agents and lawmakers here in New York, you know, it was clear New York was going to be hit the hardest following. I have a lot of friends also in Seattle in food and beverage and in various businesses, including tech, and just realizing we were so behind and that New York really wasn't waking up and didn't really realize what was happening. You know, no one that week had any clue that anyone was filing for unemployment yet. The site crashed pretty much overnight. They started staggering applications. And so, you know, the numbers, as we all know, are very much a lagging indicator. But it was very clear that millions across the country were about to be unemployed all at once with, frankly, no horizon as to how or when they could be rehired back, and lawmakers had no clue. And seeing on television that only large chains like, you know, McDonald's were invited to Washington to be part of the drafting and the third bill CARES Act negotiation, you know, our industry really woke up overnight. And across the country with the IRC and in New York with ROAR, which focuses on liaising with Governor Cuomo's office, it was just very clear. I mean, restaurants are 2/3 owned by independents, not by large chains and not publicly listed. And yet we were not invited to a seat at the table. I think that is abundantly clear. And again, I think a blind spot. I think it's the first time our industry has ever before united in this way. And I think the first time that, you know, the government at all levels, city, state, and national, really are finally waking up to the fact, you know, we've sort of been the sleeping giant. We've been intensely overregulated over the last 10 years, coupled with skyrocketing real estate prices, rising food costs, and as we all know, rising labor costs as well, which we just touched upon. It's been crushing margins silently over the last 10 years. And unfortunately, we've been taking it. And now the leverage has turned, you know, almost overnight. We are now all closed. Everyone is unemployed. And now, frankly, we have leverage and recognition for the first time as a mass employing mechanism. And, you know, as Riley outlined, one of the last few frontiers for zero barrier to entry jobs that have real career paths across the country with real mobility. And I think we've just never before been seen in that light. So, you know, what I think we've been able to do in a matter of 2, 3, 4 weeks is tremendous. We've raised a lot of money for relief for our own people independently and privately. But the biggest, you know, the biggest goal, and I think the biggest hurdle we still have is at the advocacy and policy. You know, I was talking to Riley last night, and truthfully, this whole industry went off a cliff. And as of today, it's largely insolvent. We all know we're going to be coming back to 50% drop in sales. You know, it doesn't take an MBA to do the math. It's simple, you know, addition and subtraction. you know, these businesses are insolvent. You can't go from single digit margins, have 50% of your sales cut and 99% of your costs, you know, being fixed and expect people to reopen. And now the challenge is there's real time, effort, energy, and cost involved in reopening and rehiring your teams. That's a big hill to climb, and there's nothing on the other side of it as of today. And I think it is now finally a reckoning for a real restructuring. If these are important pathways, if this is an important industry to keep us from a recession to a depression and to continue to funnel a real middle class, you know, something's got to give. And I think wholesale, we need to reopen and rewrite what it means to operate a restaurant. Sorry, that was a long preamble.
That was a great preamble. So, you know, we touched upon a little bit yesterday in our conversation of, I think this really being what you had just mentioned, a time of leverage for the industry, a time for opportunity. One of the things in working, you know, in the policy areas and working with the National Restaurant Association for many years and state associations and all these great groups that are advocating on behalf of the industry. One, it's always been the feedback that restaurateurs really don't get active, or at least as much as they could or should. What you see is some of the larger chains, many of them which are heavily franchised or have, you know, different economic models that are writing the checks, you know, for the lobbying groups and so forth, and that's been the case for a long time. We're dealing with a completely different dynamic now, where I think the common threads between all groups in food service that are going to be needed to survive are much more aligned than they ever have been, in terms of the things that you mentioned with the product supply, you know, food labor costs and occupancy and so forth. So the differences that existed prior to this crisis that, you know, created somewhat a fractured advocacy model and lobbying force, I think can be kind of put on the sidelines, and with a coordinated team effort, going to have a unique ability to get some policies in play that are going to especially benefit the smaller independent restaurateurs and emerging groups if we can find some momentum for those. And, you know, we had talked, Camilla, about, you know, this type of approach, about that 90% of commonality that you had mentioned, and just want to get your thoughts on kind of the path forward and what do you think, you know, might, you know, be necessary to justify coming back to business and using that leverage.
Yeah, I mean, I think to your earlier point as well, look, for better or worse, we don't have a choice. We either unite or we are extinct as we know it. I think that just became very clear, like I said, almost overnight. I mean, the IRC was formed in one day, so was Roar. And the ability and the traction to coalesce and I think the willingness of every single person part of these coalitions to say, like you said, look, 90%, regardless of the size, regardless of your background, regardless of the owner, regardless of, you know, how many people you serve and what you charge, 90% of our P&Ls look pretty similar. There's a little bit of leeway up and down, you know, depending on what you do, where you live, where you operate, again, the size and scope, but 90% are similar. And I would say 90% struggle with the exact same issues. Labor being one. We pay huge amounts of taxes at all levels of the organization, which is absurd. You know, payroll taxes across the board in New York are 8-9%. That's straight out of our margin, right? That's the difference between a single digit and a double digit operating margin. That's massive. We deal with occupancy. We are the ones that put leasehold improvements into the space. The landlords take the benefit, and yet we're competing, you know, for fixed rent arrangements that don't make any sense for our businesses that are highly variable. And yet on the other side, you know, landlords aren't penalized for vacancy, and there's no incentive for them to have a restaurant versus a bank or a farm, you know, or a, you know, Duane Reade. The question for governments has to be, at what point do you look at the fabric of your city? You look at the safety. I mean, restaurants make the streets safe, especially in urban dense populated areas. Having restaurants that are open and around and people around is what makes it collectively safe. And I think at some point you have to make that net something you want to encourage. You know, are there tax rebates for having food and beverage in your spaces? Are there, you know, better, more equitable treatment of leasehold improvements? Are there, you know, can we remake the standard to be percentage rent? You know, right now banks don't underwrite percentage rent when you're getting a loan valuation. That should be reversed if you have a food and beverage tenant. You know, again, there's a lot of dynamics at play on both sides of the coin. I do think reimagining and rewriting what those incentives are from banks and mortgages to the landlords and then to tenants, if these are the industries that we're trying to encourage, it has to be net neutral. And then, you know, third, I do think there's a way to reimagine labor. I mean, as you said, the difference between, you know, the tipped minimum wage being increased, the management of tips is certainly absurd. There's no other industries that are so heavily regulated as far as how and when, you know, your team members can work based on their position, based on what they do. You have to track it. You have to assess it. And by the way, the penalties for doing it wrong, even on a technical violation, are insanely punitive. Plus, you know, we're being held captive and told every step of the way how we're supposed to incentivize and encourage our teams. That's unheard of in any other business. I mean, when I talk to my friends in other industries, you know, they're mind boggled. So, you know, there's those elements. And I think third, you know, at least right now, is what kind of insurance we're able to cover and able to obtain and then actually get coverage for. Obviously, business interruption insurance is a big one right now, which I think is on the verge of cracking open. But, you know, again, it's sort of, you got to decide what's worth it. I mean, I keep going back to these past couple weeks. It's really bothered me. You know, New York City was willing to give Amazon $3 billion in tax incentives for 25,000 jobs. Restaurants employ over 500,000 people across the city. And we're being told that there's no money to assist or no tax rebate systems that are being offered. It doesn't really add up. And I would imagine that across every single city, there are similar stories of one large company getting an insane package from the government for a disproportionate amount of jobs. You know, even with the CARES Act, airlines have their own carve out, their own specific section of the CARES Act. And again, they pale in comparison to the volume of employment that our industry represents. And I think it's about time that we're treated as a coalition, that we're treated as one industry, and that we have a proper seat at the table. Like I said, without that, you know, right now you're looking at an entirely insolvent industry that, you know, I've seen in the questions and the comments, you know, you're looking at a 12 to 18 month recovery, if that, and these businesses will not reopen because they're seeing that horizon and the numbers do not add up and no one's going to bleed cash for that long. They just can't. Plus, not to mention, a lot of people have, you know, as we all know, a lot of people have personal guarantees or good guy guarantees on their leases and their contracts. The stakes are insanely high. Not to mention, like I said, I think the big thing that no one's talking about either is the loom of litigation right now. I mean, for technical violations, when you were forced to close overnight, are probably, you know, too many to count and carry massive price tags that, again, are further making these businesses even more insolvent if they weren't before. I see someone asked about changing the restaurant experience to be more educational and economic foundation oriented. You know, I would say Westbourne, frankly, is as similar to that as possible. We have a full cross-training program. We have no back of house, no front of house. I pay everyone the exact same. We have no tipping. And we've had incredible tenure and a large amount of success with that. You know, that's definitely the exception, not the norm. And I think it has worked. But even then, I don't know how you operate in New York City with a 50% cliff off sales. Like, I can tell you, I do it better than anyone. And I think our system being so different, we have no porters, no dishwashers, we do it all together. Our system top to bottom is incredibly unique. Everyone gets coffee trained. Everyone gets wine trained. Everyone learns how to do it, you know, run the POS. Everyone cooks. And even then, you know, I can't pay rent if we have a 50% drop in sales. And, you know, events and catering, which we all know for these businesses, for all of our businesses, are a big part of it. Gatherings won't come back for at least, I think, 6 to 9 months. And, you know, that's the rest of the year gone. And an enormous amount of fixed costs to grapple with. I don't see how the math pencils. And I think anyone who's gone to high school, which everyone in our government has, should be able to do the math and know that it just doesn't make sense right now.
Well, Camilla, you know, one, I'd like to thank you for all the great work you're doing with restaurateurs in New York and around the country. I know your network is broad, and, you know, to be part of this, you know, this is a coalition. This is a time where those that really have not been heard for a long time are going to have a voice. And as you said, Camilla, we're going to have leverage. And we have the framework in place for what we believe is going to be a very successful policy-driven effort to justify coming back to business if we all work together on this.
Absolutely. A lot of questions on this, and I will tell you, you know, again, my background's in real estate investment myself, and I've stood on both sides of the coin. We actually at CIM used to take a lot of chances on startup restaurants and larger groups alike. And again, obviously working for a large organization like Union Square Hospitality Group, I'm seeing a lot of these questions come in. I mean, the truth is, first and foremost, occupancy should be single digit. No business can run a healthy, you know, the health ratio doesn't make sense when you're talking about 10% or more. What's happening now is with fixed rent, even if you had a great lease, which hovers around, you know, in major cities, 9-10%, when sales plummet 50%, now your occupancy just went up to 15%, which we all agree isn't, you know, not a health indicator. That is not a healthy business right there. So when you're talking about percentage sales, it really needs, I think 8% should be the standard, if not better. And secondly, I think, you know, the challenge right now is you cannot have this many businesses negotiating one-off with landlords who then are negotiating with banks. This has to be government managed. This is almost like the largest dispute, alternative dispute resolution scenario that I think this country's ever seen. But it does remind me a lot of what came out of 9/11. You just can't have this going off one for one. It makes no sense. And for the system alone, like I said, we have the threat of labor litigation, but I also think you're going to see the threat of mass real estate litigation if the government does not jump in and get this going now wholesale. I mean, my landlord, I wrote to him on March 5th. That was way 2 weeks before New York was really hit. Like I said, I have a lot of friends in Seattle, so I felt tipped off pretty quickly. He didn't respond to my email for 10 days. Has been totally messing around, won't confirm or deny anything, will not come to the table to negotiate. And in fact, on the first phone call, he said, look, if you got to leave, you got to leave. You upgraded my space. You know, if you have to leave, great. There's no incentive for him to care about vacancy. That's the other problem. We don't have a vacancy tax in this country like England does. So what do they care? Their taxes come down. You know, they've got a space that someone took care of. You know, there's just not the equal... there's not an equal incentive here. And the flip side is also true. You know, although I think he's half a jerk and half logical, he also said, look, I've got a mortgage. Like, what do? I don't have the ability to go to percentage rent. They won't underwrite it and they won't give me a credit for it. And by the way, I also have payments looming. So why would I bleed, you know, for you, that's not in my self-interest. So again, I think this is where, you know, anyone with a legal hat on or who's a lawyer on this call, this is ADR at its best, and the government has to step in. This has to be a coordinated effort. It will not work, or what's going to end up happening is this is going to clog our legal system and drain even more capital that we don't have to waste.
Yeah, and could not agree more with that, Camilla. You know, on both real estate disputes, on, you know, bankruptcy and other distress-related matters, and on, you know, the sheer potential volume of employment-related litigation, the courts are not set up to manage this. ADR mechanisms are not set up to manage this potential volume. You know, it's the biggest train wreck of epic proportions ever imagined on the horizon, unless there's some uniformity brought to this. And that's the importance of the coalition approach. That's the importance of coming to a proposal of uniform standards on a go-forward basis. That's where it makes sense for us as a group and those on the call in this group to be active, you know, in helping to develop that ask. And you know, I think the idea is, you know, we have a direct line to one major market, you know, where we can, you know, get this across. And I know there's others to test this out on too, but getting to a point where we do have that uniformity and that, you know, that buy-in from all interested parties, as this is going to be the path forward, at least for the foreseeable future. Otherwise, there's going to be a lot of messes that nobody's prepared to handle. So for those on the call, if you know, you want to be active in this coalition, please email me in your logo too. We're collecting logos. We have some materials we're putting together, working with Camilla and a bunch of others on this team effort to get the message out there, the right one, and need your input, need your logos, and you know, in closing?
No, I mean, I think, look, I still would reinforce, I'm looking through all of these questions. This is frankly exactly the problem. I mean, you have 20 billion people who are very smart on this call who are still struggling and dealing one for one. The time, energy, capital, and legal fees that are being flushed down the drain doing this is absurd. And this is not what this part of the recovery should be about. And someone mentioned the PPP. I guess I'll add one thing on that is problem with the PPP is it doesn't work for restaurants for a lot of reasons. Most importantly, timing, what you have to do to get it forgiven, and the process obviously being incredibly cumbersome. You know, the amount of professional fees spent again on how to apply, can you apply, how do you get forgiven, you know, what do you do, what's legally allowed. It's again, a real waste of resources in my mind. And the biggest danger I see is it's also, I think, playing a part in these real estate negotiations where landlords think, great, you got a check, give it to me. But we all know that that's not the best use of those resources. And that also, that's not going to get you very far. Who cares what happens, frankly, in the next 8 weeks? We're talking 6, 12, 18 months of severe pain. It's just a Band-Aid and not a very good one. And I think, unfortunately, it's created a false sense of security, particularly related to these real estate negotiations. So I also think everyone coming away from this realizing that the PPP, like I said, just was not fit for restaurants. It was underway well before we jumped into the game, sadly. And that's what you get when you're not negotiating with the right party, in my opinion. You know, bringing those chains to Washington and allowing airlines to jump in first. I mean, I don't know if anyone read, but it's disgusting to see that the bailout that was given, I think they got 75% grants. It's not a forgivable loan. It's just straight cash to the airline industry. Again, pales in comparison to the level of employment, but it equals the amount of stock buybacks that were done in the past year. I mean, that's outrageous. And that just should not be. And if the government, again, is concerned about employment, you know, they didn't have any problem putting their money where their mouth was for airlines. And I think it's time that they do the same with restaurants. Or again, the people that are going to suffer are the people. And that's going to be a real big issue. Getting back off the cliff. We're already on the other side of it. The question is, can we get back up? And, you know, the goal is to get the government to listen and to realize, you know, what they did with airlines is going to have to be done, even to a larger extent, to restructure this industry.
Well, couldn't agree more, Camilla. And, you know, if anybody has questions, Camilla, would you share your contact info for those on the group? Or would you be?
Yeah, it's Camilla at Westbourne, WESTBOURNE.com. And yes, fellow NYU grad and Penn, if anyone else is on.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Camilla. Really appreciate all the hard work you're doing and looking forward to collaborating with you and everyone else on the call today on this coalesced effort to get things right. And this is the window of opportunity. You know, as Camilla said, if people, lawmakers want jobs, politicians want jobs, the restaurant industry is the conduit for that, but it needs to make sense. And in Los Angeles, you know, alone, some data, you know, that we're you know, informed about with the job situation there. There's, you know, about 4.4 million W-2 workers, a total of, you know, 5.5 million, which includes a substantial amount of undocumented workers. There's approximately 2 million jobs at risk. And there's a concern that 800,000 of those jobs, almost a 20% or more unemployment rate, will exist after this. And you know, to get the bottom 20% of the pay scale at work is so critical and so important. And the restaurants will be the best platform for that. And I think a lot of these leaders are starting to realize that and embrace it. There's some political considerations that they need to be, you know, that they're wrestling through themselves, you know, to do it in a way that's palatable to their constituency. And it's going to require them to, you know, make some fairly dramatic changes to, you know, how, you know, some of these folks have viewed policy, you know, as it pertains to business, especially as it pertains to restaurants. So, you know, less regulation, fewer, you know, platforms to sue restaurateurs, you know, easing up on the labor costs, easing up on, you know, anything that hits supply chain costs, and on the occupancy piece, getting everything dialed in so we have some uniform standard. And so, you know, please, if you want to be part of this, email me, and we need your logos. We'll have some cool materials, and we'll be working together on this to get hopefully a great result. So thank you, Camilla. You know, I'm going to move on to kind of some of the you know, things in terms of finance that we've talked about in previous sessions, and we've got about 30 minutes remaining here. So please keep your questions coming in. If you have them, we'll try to answer as many as we can during or after. You know, we have some updates on CARES Act funding, and we'll also touch on the Main Street loan program, which may be an opportunity for some, but it's also has a number of issues associated with that that make it not necessarily that palatable to restaurants or available. But why don't we start with some CARES Act updates? Liz, are you here?
Hi, Riley. Yes, I'm on. So I wanted to give a quick update on the Paycheck Protection Program since last week, and then turn over to Landis to give the overview of the Main Street Loan Program. Just as background, I saw about 2 hours ago, Larry Kudlow, the White House's top economic advisor, has said that the PPP program will run out of funds as early as Thursday. There's been about 1.1 million applications totaling more than $253 billion that's been approved so far. So, you know, the Congress is in talks to increase the amount, but you know, that kind of gives you the timeline of, you know, where the funds are going and how quickly they're being depleted. Okay, so since last week on our webinar, the SBA has continued to update on a near daily basis the FAQs that they're posting, providing guidance on the PPP loans. And so as a reminder, they've stated that borrowers can rely on the laws, rules, and guidance available at the time of their applications. And there isn't a need to reapply based on new issued rules or guidelines. It's not clear how they're going to review or enforce this policy since they're, you know, doling out guidance in such a piecemeal way. So, you know, but it's been said that, you know, you're responsible for what's out there when you apply. We're still waiting supplemental guidance addressing loan forgiveness. The SBA indicated in their interim final rule that was put out not last week, but at the end of the week before, that it would be forthcoming. Hopefully it'll be issued soon since, you know, many borrowers are obtaining funding. And so starting the clock on, you know, the 8-week covered period for potential forgiveness of expenses. So it would be good to, you know, have a full picture of how that would work. It may be that the SBA will just continue to update the FAQs with forgiveness-related guidance rather than issue a more formal supplement the way they did for affiliation issues. In fact, they added an FAQ addressing a forgiveness question that many of you posed during last week's webinar. You know, when does the 8-week period for covered expenses begin, and is there any flexibility to push back the start of that period, whether in the form of delayed funding or otherwise? The idea being that you might want to delay expenses until there's more visibility on when businesses can be reopened. And the SBA has stated that the 8-week period begins on the date that you receive loan proceeds. And you must receive such loan proceeds from your lender no later than 10 calendar days from the date of loan approval. So for those wanting more runway, it seems the most you can do is ask your lender to delay disbursement for 10 days. Another common forgiveness question that we've been getting is whether you can prepay eligible expenses, your payroll costs, rent, utilities, and mortgage interest during the 8-week covered period as a way to maximize your forgiveness amount. And the Act states that the expenses must be incurred and paid for during the covered period. So you can't prepay salaries or rent obligations in order to increase the forgiveness amount. But you can pay, say, like a quarterly utility bill due in July, covering May, June, and July usage, and then get credit in the forgiveness calculation for the amount attributable to that 8-week period, as those amounts would be incurred and paid for, even though not yet due. One item in forgiveness that is ambiguous and open, of which there's quite a few of those, but it's how the rule is going to apply that not more than 20% of the forgiven amount may be for non-payroll costs. It's not clear if they're going to take the gross, you know, the big bucket of eligible expenses, reduce that bucket by based on reductions in headcount and wages, and then as a last step, confirm that payroll costs during the 8-week period are at least 75% of that number, or if they're going to do the reverse and apply the 75% requirement right off the top to gross eligible expenses and then reduce the amount for reductions in headcount and wages. So, you know, hopefully there'll be some guidance or an FAQ on that. Another area in which some confirmation and more guidance has been provided this week is on the affiliation rules and how they apply to franchises and restaurant businesses. As a reminder, affiliation standards are waived under the Act for small businesses in three instances. One, for the hotel and food service industries with less than 500 employees. Two, that are SBA approved franchises, or three, that receive financial assistance from SBICs licensed by the SBA. And if affiliation isn't waived, then when determining eligibility, an applicant is considered along with its affiliates for, you know, employee counts, revenue numbers. So in regards to franchises, the SBA confirmed the way they'll assess eligibility and made clear who all can fall under that prong two. So they stated that each brand that's listed in the SBA directory will have the affiliation rules waived for each of their franchisees. And so the only way that you assess your eligibility as a franchisee is, you know, as long as you have less than 500 employees for location. So for restaurant franchisees, should mean that they should be eligible for the loan up to the 10 million cap per entity. Also, the SBA has stated that even if a franchise isn't listed in the directory, they can still request to be listed, and their franchisees will still be able to obtain a waiver of the affiliation rules if that's the case. The SBA addressed and provided some examples to an affiliation question that we've been discussing over the last 2 weeks and ever since the CARES Act was put out. And that's the question of whether the 500 per location language, which is included in the eligibility rules for restaurants, would also apply for the waiver of affiliation analysis, since the words per location were not included in that section. It was initially thought by many that the Act had meant for the per location language to also be included in the affiliation waiver section. However, the supplement that was put out last weekend didn't address this point, and so we were left thinking, and we discussed last week, that this likely meant a restaurant business with greater than 500 employees, but not on a per location basis, would be subject to the affiliation rules and would have to include its affiliates in determining eligibility. And this week, an FAQ was added that confirmed that this was indeed the case, and the per location, again, was not included in the waiver of affiliation analysis. They also confirmed that a restaurant business with separate entities for each location, and those are entities with their own EINs, but under the same parent, can each apply for a separate PPP loan. This is a strategy we've discussed with many on the phone, and it can be very advantageous for larger businesses who surpass the $10 million max loan amount on a consolidated basis. So those are kind of the main updates over the last week, and I'm going to turn it over to Landis to talk about the Main Street Loan Program.
Thank you, Liz. And before Landis jumps in, if anyone has questions on the PPP program or otherwise, please send those over and we'll try to get those answered as soon as possible. All right, Landis, Main Street Loan Program. How's that looking?
Absolutely. That is an interesting program. So as was mentioned, the Federal Reserve recently announced the terms of this Main Street Lending Program. It's contemplated by the CARES Act. So we will enable up to $600 billion in loans to small and medium-sized businesses. The Main Street Lending Program is in addition to the Paycheck Protection Program, as Liz mentioned. And the eligible employees may apply for both programs. So if you are eligible under both, you can apply for both. They're not mutually exclusive in any way. Unlike the Paycheck Protection Program, the CARES Act does not permit forgiveness of the Main Street loans. In other words, these are real loans, and it's not a, you know, disguised grant program or anything else. In terms of who qualifies, the Main Street Lending Program will provide support for small and mid-sized businesses that were in good financial standing before the crisis. As I'll explain with some of the criteria, what they're targeting with this one is companies that were already in, you know, decent shape, but receiving an unexpected shock to the system, and that this will help them smooth over a little bit. Insolvent companies are categorically ineligible. They define insolvency to include the inability to pay undisputed debts as they become due during the 90 days preceding the date of borrowing under the program. Part of that insolvency question is how quickly a company can apply. As I'll discuss in a moment, companies with negative or low 2019 EBITDA are effectively ineligible. Eligible borrowers under this program, they may have up to 10,000 employees or annual revenues of less than $2.5 billion. So this is, you know, obviously captures larger companies than many that we see in the growing restaurant industry. We've been getting some questions about whether a subsidiary can be an eligible borrower under this program. Although the information available as of yet has not addressed this specifically, we believe a subsidiary can be an eligible borrower if it satisfies the criteria. There's language in the statute and in the regulations that have been promulgated that seem to imply that subsidiaries can also participate. So what is the loan size? Their criteria for what is the eligible loan size is really what can determine eligibility for a lot of growing companies. The loan size is at least $1 million up to the lesser of $25 million or an amount that when added to existing outstanding and committed but undrawn debt does not exceed 4 times the borrower's 2019 EBITDA. So other than the $25 million cap, you take 2019 EBITDA, multiply it by 4, subtract the existing outstanding committed but undrawn debt, and that's your number, but it has to be at least $1 million. So for example, suppose a company has no debt and a 2019 EBITDA that was either negative or less than positive $250,000. such a company would be effectively ineligible because 4 times their EBITDA would not exceed the minimum loan amount of $1 million. Suppose instead that a company had $1 million of positive EBITDA in 2019, but has an existing line of credit from which they could draw down $3 million. The company's eligible loan size would be 4x the 2019 EBITDA minus the amount available under the line of credit. So $4 million minus $3 million equals $1 million for the new loan. Because of these criteria, it's quite apparent this program is designed for more profitable, established companies with relatively low leverage. Given the typical economics of emerging and growth-minded restaurants, we don't see this as being terribly applicable for most groups. But for some larger, more established restaurant groups, this could be applicable. So what are the loan terms if you're eligible? The program will offer 4-year loans with principal and interest payments deferred for 1 year. The loans will have an adjustable rate tied to the secured overnight financing rate published by the Fed, so the SOFR. The variable rate will be SOFR plus 250 to 400 basis points. As of yesterday, the SOFR was 2 basis points. So with that essentially at zero, these loans would have a rate of roughly 2.5 to 4%. Obviously, if the Fed's increase rates later on, they would increase. There's no prepayment penalty on these loans, but they do have lots of other strings attached. A company may not use the loan funds to repay any other debt. Company may not use other funds to repay this debt, the Main Street loan, of equal or lower priority while the Main Street loan is outstanding. You can still pay down secured debt or other top tier debt, but you can't pay down any junior debt while this loan is outstanding. The company must make reasonable efforts to maintain its payroll and retain its employees during the term of the loan. They have not provided any specific criteria of what constitutes reasonable efforts to maintain payroll and retain its employees. Unlike the payroll protection program, they haven't set any formulas for FTE before and after or individual adjustments and compensation. They just ask you to certify on the front end that you will make reasonable efforts to maintain payroll and retain employees. We haven't provided any more guidance on that. Also, if a company takes out these Main Street loans, they cannot pay dividends or make capital distributions while the loan is outstanding or 12 months thereafter. So suppose the company takes out the loan, 2 years from now, the world's a much different place. The company repays the loan entirely and is quite profitable. For another 12 months after repaying the loan, the company cannot distribute any cash to its owners. Similarly, if a company has securities listed on a national securities exchange, they cannot repurchase any of such securities for that 12-month period. There are also significant caps on compensation of highly compensated employees. So if an officer employee had 2019 total compensation exceeding $425,000, they can't increase that compensation if they take out this loan. And there's additional caps if any employee has total compensation exceeding $3 million in 2019. There's certain caps for what it could be in 2020 and thereafter. So at a high level, the criteria of having positive EBITDA in 2019 and effectively very little debt or even committed but undrawn debt under a credit facility puts this to be a pretty narrow group in the restaurant industry that'd be eligible for this. But for those who do have significant positive EBITDA, and if for whatever reason their existing credit facilities are no longer active, or they just don't have significant debt, this would be a great opportunity. Please feel free to let us know if any questions about this program.
Yeah, thank you, Landis. And if anyone has questions about the Main Street Loan Program, please send them over via the webinar, and we will try to answer those as soon as we can. It sounds like an option that might be available for some, but for many, it would not be applicable. And interesting, you know, with the EBITDA requirements, a lot of even, you know, strong and growing groups that have real positive, you know, store level EBITDA, but have been spending heavily on G&A and development and so forth, would not qualify. So it really rules out a lot of businesses. And that, I think, gets us to kind of the state of traditional financing, which it's like, wow, we talk about it like the old days when, you know, you used to go and there's a robust private market for investment in the restaurant space with, you know, high net worth individuals or venture type money or private equity. I know we have a lot of folks on the phone right now that are in that space. For obvious reasons, it's been very difficult to wrap one's head around making an investment in a concept at this time, whether debt or equity. We'll say that we have been seeing investments with clients. A lot of them are coming from existing investor bases, not so much, you know, new folks, but there are new folks that have expressed an interest in potentially partnering with groups, you know, under various financing models, whether, you know, convertible notes, as we've touched on in prior sessions, have been, I think, the most popular mechanism. That's, you know, a debt to equity structure where, you know, the investment would typically convert to equity at a later date with a discount to the valuation of the next qualified financing round. And usually we'll see discounts on convertible notes in the 20% or so range. Now we're seeing conversion discounts of, you know, the 20 to up 50% or so. So it's become more expensive money, as you might expect, with that particular type of structure. We've also seen, you know, interest in equity financings. We've certainly seen a bunch of term sheets on equity financings circulated. You know, I think that the challenge for a lot of folks is really getting to the finish line, because there's so much in flux that, you know, it's really hard to, you know, make the final decisions on these investments. For a lot of founder-driven companies out there, you know, there's the the obvious pain of being diluted or you know, agreeing to terms that are they're less than a, you know, palatable. And why do it if you know there's so much uncertainty that, you know, it might not even make sense to continue operations. And so most have been looking to the you know the federal programs and other ways to get financing. But we do not want to rule that out as an option. Some have strong investor networks, you know, and some have friends and family that might be willing to invest. For single location restaurant owners, you know, Landis maybe kind of touch on those. But we have the cash flow model. You know, with a lot of restaurants, you know, for those on the phone, as you know, you've structured your arrangements with your, you know, friends and family as you know, they get a percentage of the distributable cash first, and then, you know, after they're paid off, you know, the founder group, you know, gets a larger percentage of cash, and the investors retain a residual interest. So we're seeing some of that activity with you know, investors coming in and giving restaurants some, you know, what we say, emergency capital. But how do those look, Landis?
Now that's right. So we have been seeing more of those. Now we have been seeing some changes to what the loan repayment, the preferred equity distribution repayment terms. So just for an example, suppose that in a cash flow model, the company previously, or the investors would receive, you know, 70% of the distributable cash until they received a full return of capital. Instead, because of the higher risk profile in this market, they'll say, well, now, you know, we'll give you additional capital, but with respect to our additional capital, we will need, you know, 90 or 100% of return before there'll be any distributions to the founder. And then there's also taking into consideration where the company is in the repayment on an entity by entity basis. So if with cash flow model, if some of the locations have already repaid a substantial portion of the initial investment from the friend and family, then the negotiation ends up being different, right? Do we now start the 100% repayment with respect to the whole amount or just with respect to the new amount? But those things just kind of have to be worked out. A lot of restaurant groups will have a more or less common cohort of investors who will invest in multiple different locations, but it's not necessarily the same group of investors with respect to each one. And you're just going to have to work it out and figure out what's fair for everybody when you're looking at, well, have each person been repaid on which amount? It's hard to identify real clear trends of what these have been, what's been coming out, but the general trend is accelerating the repayment obligations with respect to at least the new capital, just because of the risk profile.
Yeah, and for those on the phone, I think the takeaway is, if funding is needed from the private markets, understanding your options, understanding kind of what market terms are right now. I mean, it really is, on a case-by-case basis. I mean, there's some concepts that are really, I think, well-positioned to come out of this really strong. Those will lend to better terms. There's some that might not be in that position, so that's going to lend to, I think, more expensive capital and so forth. There's always the rich relative who doesn't care approach that has been around in restaurants since the beginning of time. Love that approach. So if you're fortunate to have that in your network, that can certainly be an option. But we're obviously happy to help anybody navigate any of the private financing opportunities that may present itself to you. There will be a market developing for acquisition, for investment, and so forth. We're seeing that in a lot of places and a lot of groups starting to come together, to do that. But it's really timing as we see it right now. Not sure kind of what the right approach is and how they're going to go about it. But if you are in the market for additional private capital, happy to be a resource for you as things materialize. Well, we just have a few minutes left here today and wanted to kind of go around on some of the key people issues that we're seeing in markets that relate to labor and personnel issues. Jenna, do we have you here?
You do. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
All right.
So just really briefly, I am seeing some employers, especially those who are having success with the takeout business, bringing folk back who have been either furloughed or laid off. And so just a quick reminder to really think hard about how you're going to go about bringing folks back and have a clear path for doing so. That's the best way to avoid discrimination claims, right, is to have objective criteria that get applied to your furloughed or laid off employees and bringing them back in a nice, organized, objective way. Is a best practice that I wanted to remind you of. Similarly, as you're doing so, likely you're going to have folks who you transitioned from exempt. They're your managers who then started doing a bunch of work like prep and cooking and dishes and all of that good stuff that put them in a position where they were probably no longer exempt, and you've transitioned them to non-exempt for this time period. As you're bringing non-exempt people back and then transitioning employees who have been pinch hitting for you, it's real important to be careful about transitioning them back into their exempt status and ensuring that they're being paid appropriately by salary and that they are indeed doing the full job functions of exempt employees. So just two sort of key issue best practices as you're bringing people back into the workplace that I wanted to highlight for folks.
Thank you, Jenna. And Roy, are you on?
I am, Riley. So just to pick up on where Jenna left off with respect to managers and the kinds of job duties they're going to be performing as, businesses start to ramp up again, just be mindful of tip credit rules in your relevant location. For example, New York still has an 80-20 rule about the kinds of job duties that a person can be performing and the ability to get a tip credit for that. Those rules are still in effect. And also to just be aware of managers' participation in tip pools in your relevant jurisdictions. Again, in New York, that's still not permitted. Also, when bringing people back, this sounds simple, but I think it's important. Just make sure that everybody's being paid equally for the same job so you don't run into a pay equity or discrimination claim. There's going to be people who are going to be asking for more money because they're, in certain hardships. And it could end up being, you know, the no good deed goes unpunished, where you end up giving additional pay potentially to men over women or to different in an inequitable manner. And that could end up creating some liability down the road. Finally, just keep up to date as businesses start to reopen, hopefully in the foreseeable future, with respect to government guidance on safety and security measures that have to take place, both social distancing and then any kind of protective wear or uniforms that people have to wear in order to perform their job. The government will be providing guidance on that, and just something to be aware of so that you, employees just don't go back into work in the same way they had worked before.
Well, thank you, Roy. And as we come to a closer, I wanted to touch base with you, Janet, in Los Angeles. There's some things that we recommend. We touched on the last call that employers can do as they're rehiring to provide a much higher level of protection to them from class actions and other issues that they might have previously had. So, in terms of at-will employment agreements, and so forth, what would you advise?
Sure, Riley, it's Janet Groomer. So bringing people back is probably the best opportunity we're going to have in a while to clean up any documents that we have that we wish we had something better, and to kind of put agreements in place that we think would be beneficial. And one of those agreements that we touched on at the last call was putting in place arbitration agreements where we think that we have class action risk, because with a good arbitration agreement, we can include class action waiver language, and that's the only context in which we can kind of guarantee that language would be applicable. But doing that can help us to avoid class action litigation, even if it's well put together, even class action liability that arose prior to the agreement being signed. We can have employees agree that they won't participate in and will bring only individual claims. This is a huge advantage to restaurants because we have so many employees who do the same thing in the same way, and so we are ripe for class action litigation. So if you have an employment packet, if you are considering bringing back employees under some sort of arbitration agreement, talk to your labor council, clean up that packet, and when you onboard folks, again, that's your opportunity to get that kind of stuff signed and in place, ready to go. So I know we're about out of time, so I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, and I will, for those that have been through class action, you understand the value of this. For those that haven't, the amount of cost and expense out of pocket associated with dealing class actions is tremendous. Usually insurance is not applicable, or if it is applicable, it only covers a portion of the expense that's incurred, in addition to being a tremendous time and other drain. Class actions really are the bane of existence for restaurateurs, especially in California and elsewhere. So this is a really easy and economical level of protection that you can provide. So for those on the call, if you have interest, if you don't have that, our team is obviously happy to help get you situated economically to get in a much better spot than you already are. So with that, we're at 11:30. I'd like to stay on time around here and really appreciate everybody's participation today. If you have topics that you want to hit on next week's call, please reach out. For those that have questions in, we will try to get those answered as soon as possible. We're also available off the webinar at all times to help you with your needs. And so really appreciate your time today. Appreciate all the great work you're doing. Wishing you, your families, and your team health and wellness. And we will talk to you next week.